Well, the sermon today is coming from the passage we read in the prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 32. And we're really going to look through the whole of this chapter. So, it will be very helpful if you have your Bible open at the passage. Isaiah 32, page 631. Now, I don't know if any of the children have noticed this, but everybody in the world tilts. Did you know that? People tilt. Like this, maybe. Or like that, maybe. Or maybe they tilt forward. Or backwards. And it's not really a matter of balance. It's not a matter that people lean one way or lean the other way because they've got one leg shorter than the other or anything like that. But what the Bible says to us is this, that people in life tilt either towards God or away from God. So either your life is moving towards God and you are drawn to God in the person that you are and the way you live your life, or else you're moving away from God. The direction of your life is tilting away from God towards a more godless life. So you've got to ask yourself that then, as we start out, what direction does my life lean in? What way am I tilting? Is my life directed Godwards, or am I actually moving further away from the Lord in my day-to-day living and in the kind of centre of who I am? And I say that because that's the kind of problem that was being dealt with in the passage that we're looking at this morning. Judah is the southern kingdom of Israel. Israel, after Solomon, split in two: the northern kingdom, known as Israel or Ephraim, and the southern kingdom around Judah, around Jerusalem, known as Judah. And by this time, the Assyrians have already overrun the northern kingdom. But Judah is under grave threat. Why have these threats, these judgments come? First in the northern kingdom, now in the southern kingdom. And the threat of judgment has come, of course, because Judah, as a nation, has been tilting away from God. Instead of being a God-centered covenant community, these people have moved backwards. They have retreated from their commitment to God, and they have compromised their faith, mixing it with all kinds of different religious ideas and identities and idolatries. And so here we have a people who are in spiritual and national crisis because they have been moving away from the Lord, and because their lives are no longer Godward directed, Godward leaning, Godward focused. And so as we reflect on their experience and how God deals with them, what we need to do is to see, well, how is God dealing with me in my life? And is my life, or the life I'm living, really Godward, God-centered? Am I really reaching out for God in who I am and in what I am and the way that I live? First point, I take it you've all maybe got a copy of the service sheet. It says the far shore. Now, sometimes we can visit a place very briefly and you get a taste for that place and you think, I really want to go back. And you maybe even think, I would love to live there. I just would love to up sticks, move everything, take my family, and go and live in this other place because it's so much nicer, it's so much better. My congregation has a sister church in the southern United States in Mississippi, and a lot of the congregation have gone to visit this other church, and it's a huge church in Jackson, Mississippi, or huge by our standards. My congregation is maybe 60 or 70 people. That church is around 1,000 people. The people are very wealthy. They have a great standard of living. The weather, unremarkably, is much better than it is in Scotland. It's warm and it's pleasant and so on. And so people from my congregation, when they've gone over there to visit, they all come back and say, "Oh, that was great. I'd love to live there." And some of them have genuinely started looking for jobs and thinking, "Well, I could up sticks and I could go there. Life would be fantastic. A big church, a good standard of living, and a great climate." So we go to a place and it's different, it's exotic, and it offers us so much, and we get a taste of it and we think, "I want to go and live there." Now, in life, God sometimes gives us a taste of heaven. He gives us a glimpse, a feeling of what it's going to be like to be in heaven. That's what I mean by the far shore. That sometimes in life, God blesses us with a visit to the far shore. God gives you a taste of another world, a better world. A world where Jesus reigns in perfection. And when we get a taste of what heaven is like, then that produces within us a tremendous sense of longing that we could be there, and be there always and forever. And that's what Isaiah is doing in the opening part of this chapter, is he is allowing these people a glimpse of heaven, the perfect reign of the King Jesus. And he's doing that because he wants to create within them a thirst, a longing, a passion, that one day they will be there in that perfect kingdom where the Lord reigns in righteousness. So that's what Isaiah is trying to create within these people. And I really hope that God has created that same sense of longing for heaven in your life. Sometimes when we sit and read the Bible, you know, you may be on your own in the house with the Bible, sit and read it. And God can suddenly just move you and lift your thoughts and transport you heavenwards and give you a sense of another world that you've never really been in. It can happen when you're reading the Bible, when you're praying, when you're worshipping with other Christians. Some people even experience it in a dream or in a vision. But there are times when God does indeed, in a wonderful and moving way, communicate to us a sense of the far shore and of the glory that awaits us in heaven. And he does it for that same reason, to make us long after that day when we will be with Jesus in heaven. So these are things, these experiences of the far shore, they help our life to remain tilted or leaning in the right direction. They help us to remain Godward in our reach and Godward in our focus and Godward in our desires. They help us to hunger more after God. And that helps us in life tremendously, because there are so many things in life that we encounter that force us or try to force us in the wrong direction, away from God. And those experiences that we have of bereavement or redundancy or family crisis or marriage problems or illness or whatever it is, those negative experiences that come into our lives that seek to force us away from God, how do we resist that? How do we remain God-centered and Godward moving when we go through personal crisis? And what keeps us moving Godwards
of course, is that sense of heaven. That longing that we have, that we can see beyond the immediate crisis to what God has in store for his people in Christ. I want to look at that really briefly, how heaven, how the glory of the reign of Jesus is depicted here. Don't want to take very long to do it. But Isaiah takes his people for a glimpse of the far shore of heaven, first of all by showing them the greatness of Jesus Christ. Verses 1 and 2 are a vision of Jesus, and he is shown to be a perfect king with a human touch. He reigns in righteousness. His princes rule with justice. So that is a picture of the righteousness, the goodness, the majesty, the glory of Jesus Christ. He is a great and perfect king. And then in verse 2, we have a picture of Jesus that is centered on his humanity. And of course, the humanness of Christ appeals to our humanity so deeply because it convinces us that Jesus can sympathize with us, get alongside us, and get inside our lives and know what it's like. And so here is a man who is a hiding place from the wind, a shelter in the tempest, a river of life in a dry and weary place. Here is a man, unique, wonderful and divine, who offers complete protection and fulfillment in life. So that's one aspect of heaven, is that being with Jesus. The other aspect, though, which runs down from verse 3 through to verse 8, is what you could maybe call the freedom to feel at home, or the freedom to feel right, the freedom to feel at peace with who you are and where you are. I don't know if you ever go through the feeling where you tend to feel, well, you don't fit very well in your own skin, that you don't really feel comfortable with who you are as a person, or with some of the problems that you have as a person, and that there are things that are out of sync in your life. And a lot of people feel that kind of discomfort and dis-ease with themselves, that lack of peace with who they are. And verse 3, 4, what they do is they take us through sort of the entire human person, the eyes, the ears, the mind, and the speech. And what Isaiah is saying is that in this context, all these things tie together properly and work perfectly. That we're no longer out of sync, that we're no longer sort of disjointed as people, but that our humanity and our own sense of person will be completely integrated, and we will feel absolutely at peace with who we are. And then some people not only feel ill at ease with themselves, but many people, of course, feel ill at ease in society and in the world, and they wonder, where do I belong? Where do I fit in? As in the 20th century art and literature and cinema and so on, the outsider was a key figure. The person who always felt that they didn't belong, that they were on the outside of society looking in, but that they never really belonged. And that sense of alienation was at the heart of so much of 20th century thinking and life, and the works of Sartre and Camus and Simone de Beauvoir and all these sort of literary people and filmmakers. There was that sense of not belonging. And we may feel we don't really belong too, for lots of reasons. 5 through 8 describe 3 different kinds of people, called here the foolish person, the schemer,
and then the generous man. Three types of people, two negative, one positive. And the negative people are the people who make us ill at ease in society and in the world because they are manipulated, they're leeches, they suck the blood out of us. They are morally and spiritually corrupt and undermine what we believe is good. So these are people who use society in selfish and exploitative ways. And then the third person, the generous person, is the person who is a blessing to others, who makes society function in a manner that brings hope and rest and life and delight to people. And in the perfect reign of Jesus Christ, the foolish person and the schemer, the scoundrel, these people will disappear. That's what we're being told here. And the good person, the generous person, will be ubiquitous. They'll be everywhere. And all around us we will find people who bless us and enrich our lives and with whom we feel absolutely at one. And so that's the picture Isaiah is giving to these people. They lived in a chaotic society, a disintegrating society, where political and economic and social structures were being abused and used for personal gain. And he's saying God will overturn all of that through the perfect reign of Jesus Christ. And he will bring you to himself in peace. And he will help you to live with each other in peace. That's the vision that Isaiah was holding out to them of the far shore. And that's the direction he wants their lives to tilt in and to move towards. The second part of the passage speaks about crisis and how close crisis is to every one of us. Verse 10, if you look at verse 10, it says in a year and some days. So in just over a year is what Isaiah is trying to say here. And in just over a year, he's saying, a terrible crisis is going to come on this country. And by that he means on Judah. Now, I've got a friend whose mother is an instructor with the Advanced Institute of Motorists. So this is an institution that is there to help people to learn to drive with advanced driving skills. And it should make you a more careful driver and a more skilled driver. And one of the things that they try to teach people is pretty simple and straightforward, but I forget about it, and I'm sure you forget about it sometimes, and it's this, that when you go into a corner driving a car, you don't actually know what's round the corner. And so you need to have the car at a speed and in a situation where you are in complete control, and where if you come round the corner and there's a cow wandering across the road or a car broken down or something like that, you can bring the vehicle to a stop safely. So they work in this kind of thinking that there could always be an accident waiting to happen round the next bend. And that's the way life is for lots of us, isn't it? That round the next corner, we don't know what lies round the next corner in life. But very often, it's going to be something that we didn't expect and that we're going to find very hard to cope with. And that's what was coming to these people in Judah. Round the corner, in just over a year, he's saying, crisis is coming. What's the crisis? It's the Assyrian army. Any of the children here seen Lord of the Rings or any of these kind of films? One or two of you maybe, but they have amazing battle scenes in these films of just huge armies of really sort of threatening looking figures and sort of dark sort of clothing and terrible weaponry, and they just kind of march across the land. And that's the picture of the Assyrian army. They were this ferocious army,
highly skilled, highly trained, highly organized, lethal, who would just march across a nation and destroy everything in its path. Now, when the swarms of the Assyrian army were marching across Judah, they didn't stop and say, "Oh, look, there's Mrs. Smith's garden. Come on, chaps, let's just go round the garden and make sure you don't trample any of her flowers." And they didn't say, "Oh, look, there's Mr. Jones's cabbage field or wheat field. Let's make sure his fields are fine. Right, everybody stop here, single file round the edge of the field, careful where you go, everyone." They didn't care. They just destroyed everything they came across. They would burn your home, they would kill all your animals, they would destroy everything that you had, your fields, your crops, your gardens, your animals, your houses, and they would kill you as well. And this was what was coming to Judah. And Isaiah pictures it really well. He says in verse 10, you will be troubled, you complacent women. The vintage will fail. The gathering will not come. Be troubled, you complacent ones. Strip yourselves. There's a picture in verse 11 of people being taken away naked with no clothes on at all. Why not? They were going to be slaves, captured by the Assyrians and led away. Nakedness was a sign of slavery. And then on to verses 12, 13, 14 is the destruction and the devastation of the land as it is left empty by the Assyrian army. Now Isaiah has to show this to these people. Why? Because they couldn't see it themselves. And because they thought that everything was fine in their lives, even although slowly but steadily they had been shifting away from God and tilting off in a godless kind of direction, they thought that was okay. Because they thought that in this world you could live with God at arm's length and still be fine. They were so secure in their own prosperity and their own ability that they thought you could keep God behind a door and get on with life and everything would be okay. And so they're smug and they're complacent spiritually and they don't really worry about things. They think it's okay, we're fine. God may be outside the door, but everything will be all right. And Isaiah wants to say to them, no, you can't keep God on the fringes of life and still think that everything will be fine. You can't keep God at arm's length and still think that you're doing well spiritually. You can't keep God in a place, in a corner, and still think that somehow you're living the way that God wants you to. And that's the mistake that these people were making. They were complacent. They thought everything was fine. And yet at the same time they pushed God onto the fringes of their life. And they were moving away from Him. And so Isaiah lets them see the crisis that is coming to take away the smugness from their lives. These armies are going to come and destroy everything. Interesting what it says in verse 10. So if you picked up on it, the vintage will fail. So of all the crops that these people were going to lose, wheat and whatever else, Isaiah knows the one crop they're going to be really mad about is the grape harvest. Why would they be mad about the grape harvest? Anybody know? Do you know what comes from grapes? Wine. These people liked their booze. They liked their wine. Perhaps this was a source of a lot of the complacency in their lives. Just their alcohol addictions and other kinds of addictions that comforted them and made them complacent and careless. So God says you're going to lose even that. He speaks to them as the daughters of Jerusalem or the women of Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem in Isaiah's prophecy is is often pictured as female, as God's bride. And what he's saying is that these people have inherited the characteristics of Jerusalem. These children have grown up to be like their mother Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, of course, have become decadent and godless and unspiritual and idolatrous. And they were just the same. And so he tells them, look at the crisis that is coming. And the crisis is going to lead where? To complete collapse. Their secular, godless lives will implode, because that's what happens to secular, godless living. It falls in on itself. It can't sustain itself. You put God in the outside of life and then everything else collapses inwards. And so that's what's going to happen to Jerusalem. He paints this terrible picture in 12 and 13, 14 of a land deserted. Wild, the animals will just roam around wild. There'll be nobody to cultivate the land, to tend the animals, to take care of them. Verse 13, significantly, from a theological point of view, on the land my people will come up thorns and briars. Thorns and briars, theologically, he's rooting all this back into Genesis, into the fall, and into God's curse. Because after the fall, after Adam and Eve's disobedience, God spoke to Adam, and he said to him, in Genesis 3:17, cursed is the ground for your sake, and toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. So thorns and thistles are a sign of God's curse on the land. This is what's happening. The curse of God falling on their head. Without God, their life has fallen apart. The curse has come upon them. Why does he show them this terrible disaster? Why is God going to bring this crisis through the Assyrians? And why does God bring crisis to your life? Because he wants to turn you back to him. The taste of the far shore of heaven should make us thirst for heaven and long all the more for God. But the taste of the crisis should make us fear God's judgment and flee to God for refuge and desire God more. And so both kinds of events have the same underlying purpose, which is to move your life towards God and enable you to put God back at the center of who you are, because that's the only way that we live a fulfilled and meaningful life. Got to finish really quickly. I've been told when to finish, and it's now, I think, really. So I just want to fly through verse 15 through to 20. I called it the turning of the tide. How does the tide turn? With the pouring out of the Spirit. That's what makes the difference. And with the pouring out of the Spirit in verse 15 comes wonderful blessing. You see that in 16, 17 and 18. The people live in a land of righteousness, peace and happiness. Happiness. Verse 19 is a kind of, and 20 are a kind of summary of the chapter. Don't know if you ever go to the supermarket and get offered, you know, taste this bit of cheese and then see if you will buy it, or taste this soft drink and you might buy it, or taste this wine, you might buy it. Sort of try before you buy. Well, 19 and 20 are really saying try before you die. That's what God does in life. He lets you taste heaven. He lets you taste hell. And he's saying, try before you die. See where you want to go. So 19 sums up judgment. Hail comes in the forest. The city is brought low in humiliation. And 20 sums up blessing. Blessed are you who sow beside all waters. Two visions of life. And two visions of the future held before you. And in this world, God allows us all to taste a bit of both. And then God says, which is yours? What have you chosen? Where are you heading? What is your desire for? And your desire must be for God. For nothing less than for God Himself. In all that He is. To be in your life in a real and personal way. So I want to just say in closing that in your life and in your day-to-day Christian living, as you read the Bible, reach out beyond the ordinary to the living God, to experience Him and know Him, and focus your life in on Him.